you're describing these three aspects of a generic situation, experience, and interaction, and we've sort of characterized or made a statement about the fact that there was the printed and the written material, and that the median relationship is changing, but that, I mean, those things are all sort of simultaneous, right?
Exactly. I wouldn't suggest to you that any one of these does the determining.
Yeah. Because the fact that there's written stuff has interactional...
these things are three... You know, I always avoid naive determinism in a good dialectician. Unidirectional determinism. One reason why science could grow was because of the inventing of the printing press. Because that permitted dissemination and re-examination of the information. It is arguable, others argue in the article, that an oral society doesn't have science as we know it in literate society. The reason why it doesn't have it is because the type of record that an oral society can make does not meet the requirements of science as we perceive science. And you have to think of science in our society as a different type of science, which doctors science can write. Now, I mean, this is not a value judgment, but whatever it is, it's different things from what we consider science to be in literate societies. And it's really interesting that, for example, the development of linguistics, which happened... it was the first thing you could have called scientific linguistics, predated Greece and Rome, and happened in the earlier of the world we now call the Indian subcontinent, with Parmenides' description of Sanskrit. It was formal grammar of Sanskrit, which in some sense was light years ahead of Aristotle on language. Now, why did that happen? It happened because of a need to interpret the Sanskrit scriptures. Scriptures which had been repeated orally in the temples for generation to generation. So much so that they would become unintelligible to the people who were repeating them. Because they were belonging to a dialect which was no longer the dialect that people spoke. In other words, it was a temporary, a socially arrested dialect which had been repeated from the temple, but everything else had moved. It was a week, for example, went to church and spoke Anglo-Saxon, and this had been remembered by the priests, and they spoke Anglo-Saxon, so all going in, right? Then you go out. Yeah. So what the task that Quarini and his colleagues was, if you like, to rediscover this language that had been out-of-date dialect that was being used in their religious scriptures. So they gave it a written form in order to examine it. And they reconstructed, if you like, the meaning of this dialect. They did, if you like, a job of linguistic reconstruction. And it was rather interesting that not exactly print, at least a written form had to be there before the actual science of linguistics. Writing in print, to some extent, will tend towards the impersonal interaction. Why? Why do I say it would be printed? We have to take measures for them not to be impersonal. Well, why is that so? It's not face to face, we don't even know who might be reading it, so it's really hard to have a relationship with the unknown, isn't it? Whereas if we're talking, we have a chance of establishing a relationship. So there's, an extra tension, and we have to, in writing, that we take measures to break that down. If we are writing to a known audience, in fact, we write like we try and write like we talk.
Yeah, I was going to say that a writer is very aware that he doesn't know who will be reading him. or in fact if he doesn't, and I think you read along those lines as well. I don't think you try to construct an image of the person who is writing for you.
Well, there's various things happening, even depending, again, upon other factors in the genetic situation. Because, so for example, there are many people who, in order not to be so impersonal, do, if you like, write for a sort of image of the whom they want to address. And this is, so to say, regular investment. Written investments are targeting and have try to measure the particular type of person in the society, and they're writing for that person. Similarly, say the authors of political romances and so on, and the writing of sports reports. And all these are doing that type of targeting. So they're creating hypothetical. That, of course, is itself, again, and to a degree, impersonal, because what is it? It's a generalization, of which there may be no actual person who fulfills all those requirements. It's an abstraction. It's probably only in letters, private letters to friends, that there isn't this real element of impersonality in the written word. Because it comes from an abstraction of a hypothetical interlocutor or reader, as opposed to a real reader. And some of you may, various times, have gotten trouble writing an assignment, because you've written it for the professor who's taught the course. And then the space professor comes along and says, no, you're not writing it for me. You can't take that for granted. So that you have to play the game of a hypothetical audience. This hypothetical academic audience that you'll read your essay. Not Professor X or her or his individuality. What you're operating in is a register which has to be in person. So you can't make private jokes or refer to something which is, you know, because the professor is a real discussion in class, right? Allude to it, you have to actually state it.
I think one resists that more in a more formal academic setting. I did that in high school, make jokes.
Yes, sure.
But, I mean, when
you're taught to resist, you realize it doesn't work, you know, you're not supposed to do it here at the university.
Right, right.
Okay? So you begin to accept the impersonality of a genetic situation. And even though you know the professor is going to mark, you don't pretend you don't, right? Because in fact, he's not whom you're writing it for. You're writing for him or her as a representative of a hypothetical class of person called a professor. Now, but it also can be argued that impersonality is a necessary thing for science. That the discourse of science should not be intruded on by the personalities of the people who are doing the discourse. Because the scientific thing is supposed to be as true today, tomorrow, or in a year's time, right? And not to be personally attached. So you can't just say the impersonality comes from written, but now the very experience itself, which demands impersonality. Science is supposed to be. In other words, our mythology of science, our ideology of science, so-called
objective. There was a debate yesterday at the University of Western Ontario, which I haven't heard any of it, but I would think that it would call into question the impersonal nature of science and make it, I think that was probably rather a personal confrontation over that.
I mean,
he's about that professor.
Yes.
He's
a professor of psychology.
Everybody's taking psychology here has read this book.
It's that is interesting because, well, don't forget, I've been talking not about what science sees, but how science sees itself.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
There's no such thing. There cannot be any impersonal human activity. Because who the hell does the activity? Yes. Yeah. Right.
is part of, if you like, the mythology of its influence. It's part, if you like, of what I would call social code. This is why CCCs are important. And, particular communicating community context, time, place, and social structure. The generic situations that belong to that will be part of the social code, if they're accepted, say, as being objective or impersonal situations. And science in the West has grown up with this.
Well, how the hell did some people who write about discourse, and discourses of, you know, quite a variety, quite often start off by saying that they aren't going to bring in what you would call a communicating community context? Like, it just kills me that you can write about discourse but not make sort of any, not even, you know, quick
placing of the text.
Placing
of the discourse. Well, of course, the non-placing of it, treating it out as though it was something unique in itself and not a social product, is a typical thing that we'll always find, given a certain part of the heteroglossia of, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead now, given an ideologically right position. There are certain ideological positions which say the individual is all important and the individual is everything, because all the individuals can happen to happen collectively. You know, because then, you know, obviously, if you work from that ideological stance, something like CCC is abhorrent, because it suggests that the individual is not operating freely. You know, is this absurd idea of freedom? So, you know, you will find that. It is, again, it is traceable to a network of relationships in a particular philosophical position. Because, you know, obviously science could not be impersonal, because you don't even conduct science in persons. But what is among the rules of the game, socially established, is you pretend personality is not at issue. Now, as you say, this debate yesterday at the University of Western Ontario was very far from an impersonal investigation. On the one hand, you had Suzuki not addressing the other person's arguments at all, and operating in a purely personal way of making a moral judgment, a moral attack. Being cheered on by a crowd who are also obviously taking a very personal position, because he's perceived as being racist. Now, I mean, I find it fascinating discourse. I hope to be able to read it all and look at it all, and I dare say it will be somewhere else become accessible. But in fact, you can read Russell's own work. I dare say somebody's will print on this debate, this so-called debate. But the issue, of course, it wasn't, obviously, what one gathers, it wasn't a debate at all. It was
two monologues.
Two monologues, yeah. Suzuki monologued on high ground, and insulted him, in fact, without giving evidence. You see, when I was in a driven situation, I think he's absolutely wrong, Russell. I think he's wrong, scientifically wrong, but he's every right to try. He's every right to make the hypotheses, and every right to test them. And should certainly be allowed to test, and should certainly be allowed to announce what he thinks is something. And we shouldn't all fall apart because somebody comes along and says the Oriental races are cleverer than others, as the position in evolution, and next to the Caucasian whites and third are the coloured. We shouldn't all fall over backwards and say, oh, you can't say that. It could be true. Well, I mean, the position we're in, is the latest widely held hypothesis. You know, the consensus. You see, any scientific proof or theory is only the latest hypothesis. It's not a proof, for example, it's absolute. You know, because if that was the case, for example, gravity would still be, Newton's gravity would still be the only truth. But we know now it's not the truth. I mean, the latest hypothesis on race and intelligence, the one widely held and conventionally held, developed through the work of British and American physical anthropologists, zoologists, psychologists, during the period 1930 to really up to the present day, but particularly from about 1930 to 1965. Raymond Firth, professor of social anthropology at London, was a very important person. And then, in fact, launched a great attack on the whole racism of Hitler's Germany. Because Hitler had tamed so-called anthropologists and biologists coming along and saying, you know, a superior race, right? Jews and colored people were the humiliation of the Berlin Olympics when Jesse Owens won all those things and against all the creation. Now, a very good scientific methodology, the Brits, and to some extent the Americans, destroyed any idea that you could scientifically show that there was a superiority of ability in one major racial background than another. And it's pretty good argumentation, pretty good methodology. So that becomes a very accepted hypothesis. In fact, people mistake it from being a hypothesis for being the truth. It becomes so accepted. Now, what's happening to this man is he's challenging. He's challenging it on the basis of a certain set of correlations between an IQ which is establishable by testing and size of skull, irrespective of race. And finding it in all cases where there's a high IQ, there's a certain type of skull construction. Now, this particular type of skull construction is most common in Oriental. So he's now making a conclusion from it. Now, the point is, I'm not saying, I think he's wrong, right? Because it's a bad, in fact, it's a weak methodology he's using. It's like saying, if you know, everybody in the sea who's clever, always blows their nose on the left-hand side. So you then assume that in order to be clever, you blow your nose on the left-hand side. You know, I mean, it doesn't follow because you don't know what other factors are involved. In other words, he's using a very limited investigative methodology. So he's not proved it, right? What he is doing, though, is producing evidence that must be taken into account. And what must certainly be taken into account is we can, although we might like to, and certainly I ideologically would like to think that there is a priori no genetic difference of ability between any race, I cannot necessarily say that is so. Because I would like the world to have been so created, doesn't necessarily mean the world has been, unfortunately. And what is appalling me is somebody taking it a priori, impossible that shouldn't be so. In other words, taking it as a priori that we must all be created physiologically, intellectually equal, that the whole of human creation should be like this. And forbidding anybody to investigate the question. As well as that sermon. That's a twilight, absolutely appalling act of bigotry. It is not racism for somebody to investigate the question of possible racial differences. What would be racism is the use made of any knowledge that came out of that inquiry. Not the very inquiry itself.
Or the way it's written up.
Right? The way it's written up. And I think, from what I've seen in this book, I don't think this particular man is a racist. Certainly not a racist in the sense, for example, in which we normally use in society. It's not racist in the sense in which many of the police officers, including senior police officers, are racist. He's certainly not racist in that sense. But I think he is an inquirer in a very sensitive area. What appalls me is people suggesting he shouldn't be doing the inquiry. But I think Suzuki's been was a real mess up. Playing on a local audience, homegrown audience, he came from London.
They also had some people from New York. I mean, they organized busloads of students to go in. And
yeah.
pure amount, which is hardly fair anymore.
Yeah. Oh. No, I mean, I suspect this man's work, right? But it's not he's not willfully wrong, he's not willfully misleading, any more than Chomsky is when he talks nonsense, right? Mm. I mean, he is actually trying to find out something, right? And what I would say it's up to the scientific community to do is to test his work, counter-test, counter-hypothesize, right? And so far he's not proved anything, he knows he hasn't. What he's been suggesting is that there are indications of something. Right?
Well, what's happening in the media is very much what would have happened through Darwin's work, which was...
Exactly. Yep.
You know, you take this book, Origin of Species, and suddenly you have cartoons of Charles Darwin shaking hands with an ape, and
right. You
get the same thing with Rushton.
And yes, you're getting Rushton now, you're getting cartoons of him talking to Botha, you know, South Africa, of Botha slipping him money, which is appalling, right? Absolutely appalling. The man's got no longer to Botha, and he's not being funded by South Africa, and not paid by it, or anything like that at all.
Except the Bank of Nova Scotia.
He's a bankster of Scotia, the people who should be seen in the cartoons of Botha. Yeah, slipping Botha money. No, it's interesting that this, I mean, I mean, this is an important discourse going on in our society now. And I think it's probably worth anybody's while to examine it in terms of the movie context. But there's generic situations that give rise to this discourse. I mean, ask yourself the question. It raises some very important questions in which the discourse is a major evidence. Here we have a general uproar throughout the media involving highly important scientists who should know better, like Suzuki, over a particular researcher producing a hypothesis which shakes the status quo. And he's accused of being racist. And that's the grounds upon which she's been attacked. And yet we live in one of the most racist, constructed societies that exists. Because racism is built into Western liberal capitalist democracy. It's built into the system. It's built into the system in every single respect.
It's almost the guilt, the knee-jerk guilt.
Exactly. It's a reflection of part of the general hypocrisy and cover-up, and it's a difficult object to do it. At the same time as we have a discourse going on, which is a task force in the city, looking at racism in the police force, and, you know, with all the major politicians involved in the police force as it is, defending and backtracking on it, you know, saying how marvelously they've done last 10 years, you know. Pathetic that we use the figures to show that they how marvelously they've done in changing the composition of the police force and so on. And then this Rushton scientist gives a paper down in the States. It wasn't the States, wasn't it? He gave the paper.
Mm-hmm.
He gave the paper at an international conference and somebody picks it up. It isn't as though he's gone out looking for publicity. He gave this at a learned society of psychologists, physical anthropologists, like the sort of group in which I talk about, the semology, right? It doesn't exactly hit the front page of the newspaper, nor do you have the press sitting there. You know, but, you know, somebody picks this up just because of the race issue, right? Mm-hmm. In a newspaper or a radio thing. Mm-hmm. And then the whole thing happens, and it's
reactionary.
Yeah, it's a, what do we call it? It's a diversion. It's a diversion. And everybody who shows indignation about his racism can then go on keeping a racist police force in power.
Well, and also supporting the construct of the society.
Yeah, I mean, this whole multiculturalism, you know, the policy of multiculturalism in Canada has essentially become a policy in order to have a slave class. We are replacing a Caucasian working class by an immigrant, low-level, low-paid working class. We've done so for the last 40 years. And this is being done with maximum treatment culturalism. I just finished supervising a PhD on the English immigrant positions. And the figures are frightening. The figures are absolutely frightening. That over the last 30 or 40 years, you take all the lower income jobs, which were done by white Caucasians, they have been replaced by immigrants. That's why the immigrants have been accepted into to make a new labor force. Just replaced. That's what I mean by saying that racism is built into the society. And you don't expect racism. So, I mean, I can't really have much respect for these yowlings about Rushton's research into something which could be. But he, I mean, just supposing Rushton was right, right? Just supposing he was right, and that in the evolutionary development of the human animal, people from the area of China and India, and possibly had more likelihood to have more brain power than the rest of the world, and the whites or the black. Just supposing that was so. Yippee shit. I mean, what difference does that make? Because it's quite clear they don't have a monopoly on it, right? In other words, there's plenty of brains going around all over the world. There are plenty of brilliant black people who have, you know, despite the economic situation, they've been, there are plenty of brilliant black people. There are not a few, you know, a few brilliant white people, you know, like Einstein and Shakespeare and others, you know. And there might now be a few, you know, pretty clever. But it's not the only thing in life. It's not the only thing that makes societies, right? Is having clever people. There's all sorts of other things that are important. It's not necessarily the cleverest people, for example, who do best.
Do you think the fear comes from, you know, what if this is true? Not just coming back
to
what it's true, but what if somebody takes it and uses it?
Exactly. Oh, sure. I mean, the English discourse, the people whom I have every respect for, who are against Russia, are the people who are against the social effects of the use of what Russian is saying. Right? Like the coloured clergyman yesterday, who reported that his son, who's the only coloured child in a class, right, came home and said to his father, "Why am I the stupidest person in the class?" Because he'd been told by everybody in class today, "Hey, you're the stupidest," right, because he was the only black. This is, I mean, and believe me, I mean, this is, I'm very sympathetic with that, I mean, and the social damage that can be done. But who has created that? Did Rushton go out and publish in the Daily Star, right? Or the Globe and Mail, or put it on radio? He didn't do that. He gave a paper at a learned conference, a paper which would be unintelligible to most readers of the Star or Globe and Mail.
And they didn't flip about it, did they?
Yes, no, they did. Yes,
oh,
they
yes,
did.
Oh, sorry. I mean, oh, yes, there were attacks on it, right? There were attacks on it, and some attacks are well-motivated. I mean, some of the attacks made by his colleagues are well-motivated. And this is where I think Suzuki is very much to blame. He should have really researched this chap's work. And I think in yesterday's debate should have put things on a proper discursive level of actually attacking him on his methodology instead of just dismissing his methodology on hearsay. Because that to me is criminal. If you did something on hearsay, I'd give you a D plus or an F. Right? You'd be somewhere down there. And I don't see why Suzuki can get away with dismissing Rushton on his methodology without explaining why. Oh, some of the attacks on Rushton's work has been on his methodology, and I've given you an idea of it. It has, I think, it's making what I think is a very limited type of correlation between an IQ type of testing, which we know is a very vulnerable type of testing, very suspicious type of testing, with some physical measurements of skull development.
And he has to be aware of that. He knows that. I mean, the book he wrote, he talks about the fallibility of the IQ test because it's so socially specific.
Right.
And also the fact that you cannot imply under any circumstances, any undergraduate psychology student knows that you cannot imply causality from correlation.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
But apparently the mass media cannot comprehend that.
Oh. I mean, he is very vulnerable, and in fact, what he's really doing, I mean, if one's to be charitable to Rushton, he's raising the question, and it is something which is not can be an object of investigation. You see, it's virtually not been investigated since the work of Raymond Firth and people on human types in the 30s and 40s and 50s. In other words, it was felt they'd laid it to rest. Yeah. And they may well have done, but I mean, you can't ban an